Hi, you're listening to the My Coach Cricket Show. My name's David Hinchliffe, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. Kevin joins me again this week. Hi there, Kevin. How's it going?
Good, thanks, David. How are you?
Yes, very good, thanks. We finally got some decent weather here in the UK after a pretty wet summer. Now my season's ended, the sun's come out, and it's beautiful. It looks like a beautiful summer's day, even though autumn is starting. How's things going with you? Are you you've started your season, have you?
Yeah, we started last week. We finished the first day of the first game, and the weather's just beautiful here. We had lots of rain last month, but now it's just sun all over the place, 30 degrees, perfect cricket weather, and it's just absolutely beautiful.
That's what you want, isn't it? And how are you doing in the match?
We've actually started pretty well. Out of 50 overs, we got 292 last week with a loss of only 4 wickets. A couple of the top order guys batted really well, so looking forward to restricting the other team tomorrow.
So you've declared, have you?
Yeah, well, we can only bat for about 60 overs, but
okay,
they only bowled 50 overs, so we're not going to take the extra 10 overs tomorrow. We'll just try and bowl them out as quick as possible.
Okay, and it's a four innings match, is that right?
It's 2 days, so just 60 overs each team.
Oh, okay. So you just spread the overs over 2 days rather than play a four innings match, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. We don't do that. We don't do that over here. We would just play the full 120 overs in 1 day.
Oh, okay. A bit full on, probably. I think we're a bit too lazy here to play for 120 overs.
Well, it depends where you are in the country. In the Premier Leagues, in some of the Premier Leagues, they play 120 overs in a day.
Yep.
But some other leagues, maybe a bit lower down, you probably see a 40 over match, so you have 80 overs in the day.
Yeah.
But you spread. You have that. That's just in the afternoon. You don't have matches going on all day, so they don't start at 11. They start around 1 or 2 o'clock, and then we go through until we're done. So you can have some, especially this time of year, late September when it's autumn, basically, in the UK, it gets dark quite early. So you you can play some interesting games in the dark. So slightly different way of doing things, I think. Let's get on with the show, and we're going to start with the Ask the Coaches section as we do every week. And we got a couple of questions this week, and I'm going to hand over to you, Kevin. And if you you've got the questions there, haven't you?
Yeah, so I do. Excellent.
So if you ask those questions, and then we'll see if we can come up with a couple of answers between us.
Yep, sure, no worries. Okay, so as you would know, a couple of people have sent in some questions, and the first question is from Sandy, and she says, "Dear sir, can you tell me how to help a player in goal setting and to divide this plan into different phases?" So what do you think about that, David?
Well, that's quite an interesting one. Goal setting, generally speaking, isn't something that you divide necessarily into phases, although you may have different goals for different times of the year. So perhaps that's what Sandy is getting at.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if Sandy's a guy or a girl. I know they emailed in from somewhere in the subcontinent.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So it could be a Sandeep. I don't know. Anyway, back to the point. So if we're talking about goal setting for different times of the year, then that's what I'd be getting at when we're talking about dividing a plan into different phases. But what I would generally do there is rather than making a plan for an entire year in one go, I'd probably have 3 or 4 different periods of time where I sit down and discuss what exactly needs to be done for the coming phase, whatever that is. So, for example, if Sandy's playing at the moment, or if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, then you're just coming into your season. It will be a good time to set some goals about now for the season. And the same really if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, then you'd be looking at setting your goals for the off season. Especially in the Northern Hemisphere, you might be having a couple of weeks off before sort of starting getting back into winter style training. So it would be a good time to do it either way. Now, so what do you do? Well, goal setting is one of those things which is sort of very, very easy to find information about, and a lot of people can give you a lot of information about it, which is, it can vary from the very practical to the very sort of wishy-washy and high-minded. The stuff I like to focus on is the stuff that you can do practically, rather than the stuff that is sort of very up in the air and new age and that kind of thing. There is a place for that kind of stuff, you know. Trying to you know, what's my reason? Trying to find out what your reason is for existing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
there is a place for that kind of thinking, but it's not, you know, if you're thinking about from a cricket point of view, it's probably not the most practical way to go about it. So what I would do is I would grab a pen and a piece of paper, and I would sit down, and depending on what I wanted to get out of it, whether I wanted to do something very practical or whether I wanted to do something a bit more high-minded, I would start to write down the type of things that I would like to achieve, just generally speaking. So I wouldn't do anything particularly specific initially. I would just get an idea of what I would like to do, what I would like to achieve for the coming period that we're talking about. So in management speak, if you're looking at it from a sort of a business point of view, that will be called outcome visioning.
Yeah.
Which is basically just giving yourself license to think of the best thing that could possibly happen to you for that coming period. So if you're talking about training things, you know, you might say, you know, I want to get stronger, I want to be very strong, or I want to be very fast, and things, general things like that. If you're talking about cricket things, you'd be saying to yourself, you know, I want to be the most successful batsman in the club, or, you know, I want to take the most wickets in the club, or whatever, you know. So it would be general things that you think you could probably achieve, but it would be, if you did achieve it, it would be an incredible success.
Yeah.
Then what you do with those is you then convert, because that's pretty high-minded stuff, so you can't do anything with that. So there's your sort of overarching ideas of what you want to do. And there's a few different techniques you can use to get those out of yourself. And you can take as long or as short time as possible on doing it. For example, one of those techniques would be, say, if I suddenly gave you £1 million or $1 million, what would you do differently that you're not doing now?
Yeah.
For example, that gives you an idea of what exactly you want. Because if you had a huge amount of money suddenly come into you, the first thing you would do is the things that you really want to do.
Mm.
And I'd also say another technique for doing that is to say you only have 6 months left to live, but during those 6 months you will be in perfect health and you won't have anything wrong with you. But at the end of 6 months, exactly 6 months' time, you'll just drop dead. What will you do in those 6 months?
Yeah.
So again, you know, that gets you out the things that you really want out, because you've only got 6 months left, so you're only going to do the really important things.
Mm.
Once you've got those things, then you want to convert those into something a little bit more practical. And this is where the whole SMART goal setting thing comes in. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but that's a very popular way of setting goals. SMART stands for specific, measurable. I can't remember the rest, but but anyway, what it needs to be is the goals need to have a specific target to aim at. So it needs to be, you know, something that you can put a number on, perhaps, or something that you think you can achieve. It needs to be, but in that, whatever that thing needs to be, needs to be challenging. So it can't be too easy. It needs to be challenging, and you need to be able to measure it. That's the M in SMART. You need to be able to measure it. So, you know, ideally it needs to be a number, but not necessarily a number of runs or a number of wickets. We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
You need to be able to control it. So it needs to be individual to you, and it needs to be something which is completely in your control. So, for example, setting a number of runs, target of a number of runs for a season, isn't something which is entirely in your control. You might get an absolute jaffa first ball every ball of the season. There's nothing you can do about that. You know, you'd have to be Don Bradman. You know, you have one of those seasons where you get a load of unlucky umpiring decisions and a load of really good bowlers get on top of you and you can't do anything. That could possibly happen. So you can't control everything. So you want to be careful about setting a number of runs, for example, as a target, or a number of wickets.
Mm.
Things you can control are, you know, how many times you go to training, for example, what you do during that training, what sort of routine you have on the start of a match day, things like that, things you can completely control. And you also need to be flexible. So if you find things aren't working for your particular target for reasons which you can control or you can't control, if you find things aren't working, you have to be flexible enough to be able to change those goals. So once you've done that, you should have you should be able to, for each sort of wishy-washy type thing that you have in mind, like I want to be very strong, or you know, I want to be a very good batsman, you should be able to make a list of specific, measurable, challenging, self-controlled, time-related, and flexible goals that you can do for each individual one. So you should have a list of those under each individual thing. Once you've got those, then you can start working on them. But you shouldn't leave it at that, because you should continually go back to those things and see if you are achieving those goals. So maybe once a week, maybe get a notebook, write down each thing that you're going to do, like I'm going to go to training twice a week, you know, I'm going to go to the gym twice a week, whatever your particular thing is, write them down, and then at the end of each week, just tick off the ones you've done and cross the ones you haven't done. And then you can measure how successful, you can assess how successful you're going to be. So as long as you're doing that, then you can change things as you go along as well. So it's important to be able to keep assessing as you go along, not just do it as a one-off thing and then forget about it. And then in 3 months' time, you come back to it and go, oh, God, I can't even remember what I did. So constantly monitor what you're doing. And base all your training and all your plans and everything around those specific goals. And as long as you do that, then you have something to check against, and you have some goals which you can meet. Now, to be, obviously everybody's individual, but to be specific about it, I would say that I would split things up into three for the year for goal setting. You may have goals which are longer than a year. For example, one of your goals might be, you know, I want to play international cricket. If you're 15 years old, then you're probably not going to be playing cricket, international cricket, for a number of years, if at all. So you might want to think ahead and start planning things, you know, on a year-by-year basis. But if you're talking about a year, which is what most people are talking about, then I would split it into three. I'd split it into three in the same way that you do your periodization for your cricket training. I'd have a pre-season, in-season, and an off-season. There are other ways of doing it. That's the way I would do it. And then, for example, for off-season, I would focus on improving my fitness, as an example. Pre-season, I would focus on improving certain particular skills, something maybe I'm lacking, develop a new shot, that kind of thing, and also my mental approach. And in season, I'd focus on maintaining the gains that I've made while I wasn't playing, and also working on specific things during the season that you couldn't do out of season, you know, playing competitively, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite a comprehensive answer to that question. I hope that covers everything for Sandy. Have you got anything to add?
Probably something I could encourage Sandy to do is have like a player diary. So record everything that happens in the season for him. Because I know, especially for me last season, it helped me a lot. So whenever I had a good game, I'd record it. And if I was having a particularly bad game, I'd go back to that good game, read what happened, and sort of pump myself up, get that self-belief back into you. And that helped me a lot in my goal setting, because I was really wanting to get more wickets last season. And even although you said I wasn't, like, you're not in control of getting a wicket, there might be a really good batsman at the other end. But if you have self-belief, you get the belief that you can get anyone out, you know. I mean, if Brian Lara was standing in front there, you believe you could get him out. So it's just getting self-belief into your game. And I believe like a diary, player diary, would help him a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, your goal was to have self-belief.
Yeah.
Rather than to take wickets, yeah. And the way you got that self-belief was to keep a diary of what went right.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing to do, actually. And on a side note, one thing I always recommend players to do is every time you go to training or every time you go to a game, as soon as you finished, make a list of five things that you did well during that practice or during that game. It doesn't matter if you had the worst game of your life. You're out for a golden duck and you bowled 10 overs for 112.
Yeah.
that there's going to be, you're going to be able to think of five things that you did well, even if it's I put my shoes on the right feet. you're going to be able to think of something. So you can come up with five things, and then, as you say, you can go back to those five things and build up your self belief over time.
Yeah.
I got a story about that actually. When I was learning how to be a coach, I was taught by a very famous coach in the UK, and he told me that you always have to find something positive to say about somebody when they're when you're coaching them, because it's very important to focus on the positive and sort of try and push the negative to one side. So he was he was coaching a kid who was terrible. He was the worst player he'd ever seen. He was batting in the nets. He was all over the place. He couldn't think of one good thing to say to him. But he wanted to say something good. They called it a praise sandwich. You say something good, then you put in a criticism and a suggestion to improve, and then you put in another piece of praise. He couldn't think of anything to say to this kid who was just a complete klutz. So what he did was he walked down the net to him. He stopped them bowling. He walked down the net to him, and he said to him, "Well, that's a very nice pair of batting gloves you've got on there," because he couldn't think of anything else to say.
Yeah.
And the kid said to him, "Oh, thanks very much. They're not mine. I borrowed them from that kid over there." So he couldn't even have a nice pair of batting gloves, which is a bit of a sad story. But I don't know how that ended. Maybe he went on to play for England. We'll never know.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the question. So we've got another question. Is that right, Kevin?
Yeah, that's right. The second question is, "Dear sir, my son got selected for the district cricket team under 14s, and my son is 10 years old only. I would like to know the food items that can be given to him to make him energetic as well as strong. Thanks and regards, Raja."
Well, thanks for the question, Raja. That is a very good question. Interesting way of putting it. What foods can be given to make him energetic as well as strong? I would say that you're sort of focusing on one part of the whole picture there. First of all, I wouldn't worry about it too much. If you've got a 10-year-old who isn't tearing around like a mad thing, then I'd like to swap him for my 7-year-old, who is absolutely mental, and he never stops. So he should have plenty of energy anyway. But if he hasn't, then you don't want to just look at the food. You want to look at the whole picture. Why is somebody not particularly energetic? That's something that only Raja can really answer by looking at the whole picture. But we can focus on the food side of it as well for now. But I do want to really stress that it's about more than just food. It's about how you live your life, you know, how much sleep you get, how much exercise you get, what sort of attitude you have to life, a whole wide range of things which is not just related to food. But there are certain things you can do to make yourself stronger and more energetic through eating. That definitely is a very important component, nutrition.
Yeah,
I'd say the key, there's two keys to it. One is that energy comes from sugar in the blood, called glycogen, and that the way to get energy in that way is to eat food which is high in carbohydrate. So you want to eat whole foods rather than just sort of sugary stuff. So you don't want to be eating sugar, but you want to be eating stuff which will allow your body to create enough energy for you to use. So whole foods like rice, pasta, potatoes, stuff that's quite high in carbohydrates. Those are three starchy carbohydrates. And you also want to look at food which is relatively high in carbohydrate, which comes from fruit and vegetable sources. They're non-starchy, so they have a slightly different effect on the body. The difference there is, with starchy carbohydrates, you get much more of a response from a hormone in your body called insulin. Now, insulin has quite a few roles. But one of the things it does is to help your body store energy as fat if it doesn't use it. So what you have to be careful of is if you're eating foods which are a lot of foods which are high in starchy carbohydrates, things like bread and pasta and potatoes and rice, and you're not exercising enough, then there's an imbalance there, and the insulin will transport all that excess energy, all that excess sugar, which is going around your blood. It's going to have to go somewhere. It's either going to have to go into your muscles to give you energy, or it's going to have to go be stored as fat. So you have to be careful how much starchy carbohydrates you eat if you're thinking, well, carbohydrates give me energy, because it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really happen as much with fruit and vegetables. I'm talking about real fruit and vegetables rather than sort of fruit flavored yogurts and things like that. I'm talking about real fruit and real vegetables. And you can't really, there's barely an upper limit to how much certainly vegetables you can eat. Perhaps there is in the terms of fruit, but I wouldn't worry about even fruit too much. But vegetables, you know, you could, the recommended amount in the UK for fruit and vegetables is 5 portions a day. I would say you probably want to have at least 5 portions of vegetables a day, plus a portion or two of fruit on top of that as a minimum. And the upper limit, there is no upper limit. If you can cram in 15 portions of vegetables and a couple of portions of fruit in a day, then great, that's going to give you loads of energy, not only because of the carbohydrates, which will give you much less of an insulin response, but also because of all the good stuff that's in fruit, all the antioxidants and things like that, which just gives your body a boost, stops you getting ill, stops you getting coughs and colds and things like that. So generally you'll have more energy. So the way to go there, I would say, is just lots of fruit and vegetables, simple as that. And that'll give you plenty of energy. The final thing I would say is healthy fats. That's an important thing to get. You know, there's a big push for low fat. You know, don't eat food with fat in it. But if you're getting fat from a healthy source, and you're not getting too much, as long as you're getting enough to give you the right amount of fuel, then you can eat things like avocados, nuts and seeds, and whole foods again, which are relatively high in fat, but will give you the energy, because your body fat is a nutrient. Your body needs fat, so you don't want to be going on a low fat diet necessarily. You want to be eating plenty of whole foods with fat in it, and a big thing that we focus on at the moment is omega-3. That's a type of fat which is mainly found in fish sources. Although you can find it in other sources, but you know, famously sort of salmon, fresh tuna, that kind of thing. You can also find it in walnuts and again leafy green vegetables, but the main source is fish. That is purported, that's considered by many people to be a sort of a wonder fat, because when we as humans were developing, we developed on coastlines, so we ate quite a lot of omega-3 fats. These days, because we live in a more sort of processed food lifestyle, we eat a lot less omega-3 fats. So really, the ratio of omega-3 fats to omega-6 fats, which is the other type of fat which doesn't get mentioned very often, is completely different to when we were sort of developing our brains. And so there's a big theory at the moment, and there's a lot of research to back it up in different ways, that fish oil does all sorts of good things. It prevents disease. It boosts your metabolism and lots of other things which I can't think of at the moment. But yeah, if you're going to go with any supplements of any kind, then a fish oil supplement will do the job, or eating sort of fresh oily fish a few times a week will also do the job.
Yeah.
So that'd be my advice for Raja. Have you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, I also think like it's really important for Raja's son to start eating healthy at this age, especially because if you start him young, as he grows older, he'll learn the importance of eating healthy. And if he's in the district team already, pretty soon he'll be in the state team with eating right and good training and technique and everything. So just starting well young should be right.
Absolutely, it gets you in good habits. And it also goes back to that goal setting thing that we were talking about before, about stuff you can control.
Yeah.
Setting goals about stuff you can control. If he wants to get into the state team, then setting a goal of eating healthy meals every time you eat is a great goal to to be setting. So well done, Raja.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Okay, so that kind of sums up the questions for this week. Couple of questions only this week. So now we're going to move on to the to a feature that I've been looking forward to doing, which is a review of Bob Woolmer's and Tim Noakes's new cricket coaching book, Bob Woolmer's Art and Science of Cricket. And both Kev and I have got a copy, which I've got here. Here's mine. It's quite, as you can make out, it's quite a healthy thick book. If you don't like the book, I'd recommend buying it to prop up a coffee table with a missing leg, because it's very thick, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, it's like a textbook, like a university textbook. It's that big.
It's like a It's like a university textbook. It's 655 pages long, which is quite extraordinary, and it goes into a depth that I didn't think that a normal coaching book would ever go into. I've been reading it. How far am I in? Let's have a look. I'm 187 pages in, and some of the stuff in here I've not come across before, which is quite amazing, because I spend pretty much all my time trying to find this kind of stuff online and searching through different books and finding old books and things like that, and just spending so much time trying to find all these things, and Bob Woolmer's book has just sort of put them all in one place, which is fantastic. What do you think of it, Kevin? You're about the same place as I am. You're just in the batting section at the moment, are you?
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, there's so many topics that have never been touched before. Like, you watch masterclasses on TV, you read a lot of other books. It's never been touched before, and you wouldn't even think about it. But this book has really made you think about cricket in a different way, and really brought out the sort of the hidden secrets, as you would say. Like, you wouldn't expect the secrets that the international cricketers get would be available to club cricketers. So it's really great that everyone can be exposed to it.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it goes away from the traditional cricket book, by not just focusing on skill and technique. It does focus on skill and technique, and there's almost 300 pages of techniques.
Yeah.
There's a big chunk which is just kept focusing on the mental side, on the strategic side, the coaching, how to coach, and also the science of it, the physiology and that side of stuff.
Yeah.
Which is exceptional. The chap who did a lot on the physiological side is Tim Noakes, who is a very famous researcher and author on exercise physiology. So some of his stuff is just brilliant. But he puts it in a way which is relatively easy to understand.
Yeah,
I've read the fitness section from cover to cover, I was very impressed by Tim Noakes' section on sort of what happens to your body when you're playing cricket. He's got some interesting theories there, and he covers all the different sort of ways of looking at it from a physiological point of view. But they do it in a way that is designed for someone who's just a cricketer who just wants to know. They don't necessarily want to know the ins and outs of it. They just want to know what difference it's going to make to their game on a Saturday afternoon. So that's brilliant. The one criticism I would make of the fitness side of it is the strength element of it. Although they do go into quite some detail about strength and power, which is quite a leap forward compared to most cricket coaching books, which barely touch it. The suggested programs that they use are a little bit archaic, I've got to be honest. If you've listened to this podcast at all in the past, or read the My Coach site, then you probably know my thoughts about isolation training, particularly the bicep curl, which is one that gets quite a lot of attack from me. I'm not a fan of any kind of isolation training, but this book has some sample programs in here, and it recommends using machines, which I'm against. It recommends sit-ups and bicep curls, which again I'm against, and it doesn't really go into any detail on the why they've chosen that particular thing. I'd like to see more of why it's been chosen.
Yeah.
But that's a fairly minor criticism. The overall, I'm just gobsmacked by the entire book. I wasn't expecting it to be this big, and I wasn't expecting it to be this detailed, and I certainly wasn't expecting to get as much from it as I've got. But pretty much every page has something on it, something new on it, which made me think, which has made me think. So as a legacy to Bob Woolmer, I think it's outstanding. There's no other way to describe it.
Yeah, it's going to help a lot of people.
Oh, well, hopefully, yeah. The limiting thing of it, I think, is it's so big, people might be put off by it. Because I can imagine going into the bookshop and taking one look at it and going, no way am I ever going to read that, and then walking out again. But, you know, even if you buy it for just one of the sections, I mean, the batting section has Jack Callis for the demonstrating the shots. You can't really argue with that, can you?
No,
if you just use it for the skills, even if you just use it for the skills, or just use it for the mental approach, it's worth every single penny. Because I'm not in a position to make a guarantee, but I guarantee anyone who just reads the first 100 pages of this book will improve their game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I also think that Bob Woolmer's traditional approach to the game has also highlighted this the techniques in the book. He's mixed the modern techniques with the traditional techniques, because he used to be a player as well himself. So it's really good that there's a mixture of two approaches that can really help players nowadays. Because I think players nowadays forget a lot of the traditional approaches and get more modern and modern.
Yeah. So that's also helping with the people who the traditionalists who sort of don't like the suggestion of science coming into cricket. So
yeah,
I think he's covered all the bases there.
Yeah.
In a lot of detail.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'll put a link up to that book from Amazon in the show notes. So if anyone wants to pick up a copy, please go to the please go to the show notes and click on the link, and that will take you through to Amazon to buy a copy. If you have a copy already, you can let me know what you think. The email address is mycoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycoach@pitchvision.com. And also, just harking back to the Ask the Coaches section, if you do have any questions that you want to be answered on any topic related to cricket, then you can use the same email address, mycoach@pitchvision.com, to get in touch with myself and Kevin, and let us know what you think of the show and ask your questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on, we're going to do Kevin's going to do a little bit for us on selecting a pair of boots, because you just got a new pair, isn't that right, Kevin?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I was doing a lot of research into it for the past 2 weeks because I needed a good pair of boots for bowling and batting especially. So just one pair of boots because I'm not that rich. But anyway, I went to my first sort of choice was whether I needed rubber spikes or metal full cricket spikes. And I found the cricket spikes to be more helpful because we are playing in a lot of turf wickets. But if you are playing in synthetic wickets, it would be sort of advisable to have rubber spikes. But if you do get the metal spikes, there are sort of adjustments. And you can change those metal spikes into rubber spikes as well. So, yeah, that should be all right. But because I'm a bowler, I found it's especially useful to have to get high-cut boots. Because as bowlers, we have extreme stress on our ankles. And with high-cut boots, and there are... some boots have ankle straps as well. It really protects your ankles, and the more protection you have on your ankles, the more confidence you'll have in yourself to bowl quicker and faster. And not only for bowling, I found that while batting, a lot of the problems batsmen face is getting sand shoe crushes on your toes like good fast Yorkers, and that really puts them off. And a lot of the shoes I found came with toe guards, and that was really new to me because I've read of a lot of people improvising and putting like mouse pads into their shoes. I think a few guys on Pitch Vision did that as well. But these toe guards really came in useful. And if you didn't want a shoe with the toe guard, you could get a detachable toe guard. So you could put it in there when you need to use it and take it out when you were fielding or bowling or whatever. So
Yeah.
that was another new find for me as well. And I was talking to the guy in the store, and he told me that a lot of the problems with cricketing shoes are people either tie their laces too tight or they leave them too loose. And he showed me these shoes from Asics,
Yep.
and they were really, really easy to tie, and they didn't allow the shoes to be tied too tight or either too loose. So it enabled sort of a really comfortable feel. And he also showed me about the cushioning in shoes.
Yep.
And as a bowler, you need a lot of cushioning on the heel as well. So where you land, he said, you probably need more cushioning on your heel. Whereas for batting, it would be spread all around. So, yeah.
Excellent. There's a lot of research going into boots at the moment, generally speaking. One problem that has been seen quite a lot in basketball is players with those high cut boots, they like them because of this extra support that it feels it gives them.
Yeah.
But it also reduces their mobility in their ankle.
Yeah,
So
true.
over a period of time, their ankles get sort of less and less flexible, if you like,
Yeah.
and that leads to injuries in other parts of the body because your body's having to compensate. So the knee, for example, tries to compensate. So you see knee problems because of a lack of mobility in the
Yeah.
ankles. So the last thing I do is say don't use high cut boots
Yeah.
because they do give support at the right time.
Yeah.
But what I would say is spend some time working on improving the strength and mobility of your ankles if you're going to bowl in high cut boots. I would say that's a very very important thing, and it's often missed out because it's not you don't it's not like lifting up a big weight. You don't necessarily feel the benefits of it straight away, but it's an injury prevention technique of just sort of using your ankles through their entire range of motion, when you're warming up for your cricket matches.
Yeah, true.
Just find a wall, put your foot near the wall, and then bend your knee so it goes to touch the wall. And the idea is to get your foot further and further away from the wall because that then increases the range of motion that your ankle is moving through.
Yeah.
So that do that for both do that for say 15 times for each ankle as part of your warm up. And that will sort of keep the mobility in your ankle if you're using the high cut. The other thing which a lot of research is going into now is the different types of shoe for a different type of running style, because some people run on the outside of their feet, some people run on the inside of their feet. So
Yes.
you can now get trainers which are for runners which are designed for that kind of different types of
Yeah.
runners. I don't know of cricket boots that do that. I've not heard of any cricket boots that do that, but it's an interesting area, and I think one that's going to be looked into a lot because, especially with bowlers, there's so much. The feet are so important because it all starts with the feet, really.
Yeah.
So the better the boots, I feel the better the bowler. I mean, obviously, you still have to have a lot of skill if you're going to be a good bowler,
Yeah.
but I think the boot is the technology of boots is a bit behind. The technology of other things, so it'd be nice to see them moving forward with those because the feet are very important for both injury prevention and also, landing right is the start of your action, isn't it? So that's important.
Yeah.
Okay, just looking at the time, I think we're probably running a bit short of time now, Kevin.
Yeah.
I think we're going to wrap up the show about now.
Yeah, sure.
As I said before, if you want to get in touch with myself or Kevin, you can do so at mycoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycoach@pitchvision.com. And thanks very much again, Kevin, for chatting to me. Hopefully
No
next week we'll
problem.
have
Thank
something
you
a
very
little.
much.
Yeah, excellent. Hopefully next week we'll have something a bit different. I'm hoping to line up an interview for next week, so we'll see if we can get somebody else on the line for next week. And that's cool. All we've got time for now. So thanks very much initially, and we'll both speak to you again next time.
Thanks.